We know that there's a mystical depth to everything in Torah, but when it comes to the idea of Rosh Hashanah, you could say that almost all of what has to be studied about Rosh Hashanah is in the mystical depth. It means that since it's a day when person's being judged, which means really that you're just being exposed as what you really are. It doesn't mean judgment in the sense that we understand in childlike terms. It means that what you actually are is being revealed, and if you're sensitive, it can be that it's actually being revealed to you as well. In fact, one should be sensitive enough to know how one's judgment actually is going on Rosh Hashanah. If you don't know how it's going, if you don't know the judgment that's being issued at that time, then there's a problem in your own self-awareness. Not that a person can know what will be done to him or her that year, that a person can't know, but the judgment that is the person's core, that a person should be aware of. And that being exposed to oneself, or being exposed, that's in the core of what a person is. Not a yontif of mitzvahs on the outside, shaking a lulav and other things. The mitzvah that we have, or the work of the day, let's say, is just to be clarified. There is a mitzvah of shofar, of blowing the shofar. We'll try to see how this idea of shofar actually fits in with the mystical depth of coming to some clarity or crystallization of understanding of what each of us actually is. Maybe the way to begin is like this. We said a few days ago, just before Slichos, when we discussed the subject, I don't want to bore those who are here, but who was here then? Where was everybody else? There's an idea as follows. Let's try to build that picture and take it further. There are statements that say, many mystical sources that say that Rosh Hashanah, what's being laid down or what you've been judged for is your intentions. Not your actions, but your intention. That's a remarkable thing. Because if Judaism, if there's any system in the world that doesn't emphasize your thoughts, but rather emphasizes the practical application of those thoughts, in other words, we don't have any crime in Judaism that's called attempted murder, for example. Even thoughts and intentions that you try to carry out are really not actionable in Jewish law. We judge you by what you did, by results. We understand that that's the wavelength of reality in the world. But despite that, it seems that Rosh Hashanah is a yom tov of intention. It's what you intend to be. Of course, it's not so simple. That intention has to be acted out over the next 10 days, culminating in a Yom Kippur, which crystallizes what your intentions were in practical terms, and then the rest of the year you have to actually do them. But it's a yom tov of intention. Let's see if we can try and understand what that means and what that has to do with the shofar, and what is the kind of work that a person has to do between now and then and on that day of introspection to try and gain some insight into what they've become. Now, the beginning of the idea is something like this. The Gaon of Vilna says, explained by certain of the more mystical commentaries, that when one wishes to know what judgment is being issued on Rosh Hashanah, most of us actually are pretty confused about what exactly is being judged. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that discusses the subject, one of the Rishonim, Tosfos in fact, comments over there that what a person's being judged for on Rosh Hashanah is the next world. That's what it says. You're being judged in the next world. The question to be understood is, what are you being judged for? Are you being judged how you look in the next world? Or are you being judged how you look in this world? So that clearly says that a person is being judged for the next world. That's what it says. Now the problem with this is as follows. Briefly, what sense does it make to be judged for the next world while you're in this world? What sense does it make to be judged how you look in the next world on Rosh Hashanah, which is the beginning of a year in this world? The way a person looks in the next world, we know. The way you look in the next world is how you look in the last second of life. The way you look, exactly what your spiritual balance is, or your spiritual nature, let's say, what that is in the second of transition between this world and the next world, that's how you look forever in the next world. The whole thing about the next world is you can't make any changes there. You can just coast, if you like, at the level of the momentum that you generated here. So you can't do anything new there. But you can certainly do new things while you're here. You can do tshuva, you can fix up things that you did wrong. You can start new things, make new mistakes, you can correct old mistakes. So the point of judging a person in the next world is absolutely clear. Nobody argues about that. That the way a person is judged for the next world is in the second of transition. In fact, the mystical commentaries say very frightening things. They say that the moment of transition, the most severe judgment, is the final judgment that's given in a moment of greatest ordeal. There are mystical sources that say that when a person moves from this world to the next, what happens is that the instant after a person, lay alone, who passes away, the first thing that happens is not that they are exposed to another reality that's higher than this. There's another thing that happens first, and that's an experience of nothingness. There's an instant, whatever an instant means in that dimension. There's an instant of pure blackness, of just nothing. A person's conscious of the nothingness. And in that moment, your own negative inclination, your own yetzer, your own negative power that tries to kill you, speaks in that moment and says, you see, I told you there's nothing here. And if a person weakens in that moment and says, well, there's nothing, you lose everything. Everything, a lifetime of work can be lost in that moment. Of course, there are unfair ordeals. It's only in proportion, the difficulty of the test is only in proportion to a person's ability to cope. But there is such an idea. And only if a person holds strong, when it looks like there's no way out, that means there's no bodily effort that can be made anymore. There's no going back, that's clear. And yet it seems like there's nothing here. The biggest, cruelest joke and hoax of a person's life, even in that moment of disappointment, a person has to hold strong in emunah. Because of course, emunah is only, faith is only when it doesn't look. The test of emunah is when things don't look the way your emunah says they should be. When things look right, it's not a test of emunah. Faith is not faith when there are proofs for you. That's not faith, that's not a test. Faith is only faith when things don't look the way they should look. Then it's a test. And the final test is the largest. The most, the toughest. So there's an instant when a person feels that it looks as if there's nothing. And then if a person holds strong despite all odds, then a person's exposed to the next level, revelation of the next world, begins to unfold, whatever that means. What do we see? We see that there's a critical moment, and how you fare in that last ordeal, that's the definition of what you are permanently. So again, what sense does it make that you should be judged now, this year? Certainly it's going to change according to what you do the next day, the second day of the year, and the third day. And certainly it will change and be finalized in the final instant of a person's life, or the first instant of the next, let's say. That's one problem. And there are many problems that come out of this problem. One of them is the greeting that we issue each other. We know that there's nothing accidental, even in the most seemingly superficial Jewish custom. When we give each other a greeting on the night of Rosh Hashanah, we say, L'shana Toiva, Tikasev, Teichasem, may you be written and inscribed and sealed for a good year. The problem is that if the Gemara says, if Tosafot says that judgment is in the next world, how come we wish each other a good year? If the judgment that's being clinched now is how you look in the next world, so then what are you wishing somebody a good year? Here's a finite slice of time in this world. That's not what the judgment's being given on. And many other questions that are based on the same idea. So the answer is given as follows. This is the meaning of the Gaon explained by some of the later mystical authorities. They explain as follows. Let's see if we can work this out together, clarify it. The judgment that's been issued on Rosh Hashanah is the judgment of how you look in the next world now. Not because that's how you will look in the next world when you get there, but because depending on how you look in the next world, which really means how you look in reality, how you actually are spiritually, the way we put that is how you would look if you transition to the next world now. If you would be going there, what would you look like when there's no more activity, no more life energy that can be used or expended? The totality of who you are, your otherworldly identity, that's what's being established now. Why? So that it can be decided what you need this year. according to who you are in reality. In other words, the reason that you're being judged in the next world is not to give you that share in the next world. That'll be given when you get there. But according to how the judgment is of what you are in reality, where you're holding in the next world, as it were, now, so dependent on that can be decided what you need this year here. Start explaining. Let's try and see it from this angle. There's a classic idea in Torah thinking that sometimes righteous people suffer, and sometimes decidedly evil people prosper. So there are many, many dimensions to this issue, but one of them, one of the core dimensions to this issue, is as follows. If a person's righteous, which means that they are established in the next world, that means that if they could transition, if they would move now from this world to the next, they would be in a place of positivity. That means that their identity is one of positivity. Yes, they've done certain negative actions, everybody has, and those have to be pruned. Those have to be corrected, let's say. And the ways of correcting the negative actions of a person who's positive is either through pain, suffering, and that suffering can take, there are other ways, but there are other ways, the easier ways too. But if a person doesn't take the easier ways, then what's left is the experience of certain kinds of suffering, because certain kinds of suffering sensitize a person to the insensitive areas that you caused by overlooking certain things that you shouldn't have. And for sure, you will be forced to grow that sensitivity, to culture or cultivate that sensitivity that you were supposed to gain and didn't gain. But that pain can be experienced in this world or in the next world. So the sources say this. There's no question it's much better to suffer that pain here than in the next world. Because pain here is just a temporary experience. It's experience of lopping off or pruning. It's an experience that affects... Let's put it this way. It's an experience that can be felt only by the finite human capacities. But pain in the next world is felt by the neshama itself, because that's all there is in the next world, and pain there is enormously worse than pain here. Gemara tells about Rebbe Elazar Reb Shimon, who asked for suffering in this world. We're not allowed to do that. Certainly not allowed to take on sufferings, certainly not allowed to do things that cause suffering to ourselves. But he felt that he'd done something that was questionable. Actually, the Gemara proves it certainly wasn't questionable. But because it was possibly questionable, he decided it would be better to suffer in this world. And he asked for suffering. And the Gemara says that every night, sufferings used to come upon him. He used to take away buckets of pus from under his bed the next day, wounds and injuries. And in the mornings he would say, leave. He would tell his sufferings to leave so he could study Torah. And all day he learned, and he'd lie down on his bed at night and say, come. And that, I think the Gemara says, for 13 years he suffered like that. Because of something that was, in the most refined way, questionably wrong in this world, rather than suffer in the next. Helps to understand suffering in this world. Perhaps it helps also this understanding to be positive about difficulties in this world. We're talking here about difficulties that you didn't choose. Difficulties that you chose through unwise decisions that you should have known better, those you're fully accountable for, and those you'll be made to suffer more for also. We're talking here about things that you didn't ask for. The sufferings of things you ask for also do atone. It's not tonight's subject. Therefore, somebody who's positive in the next world, that means the clarity of their situation is that they've worked on themselves to become somebody who really is working in the right direction, although they've made mistakes, but entirely the core of their personality is positive, so they have a share in what's called the world to come. Not paint a one-dimensional picture of it, whatever that means. But because they have to pay for things that they did that weren't right, so the kindness that can be offered to them is that they can be made to pay in this world and not in the next. And that's one reason why somebody who may be tremendously positive spiritually may have to go through very difficult experiences in this world. Why? To settle the accounts, to prune off those branches, as the Chazal say, that hang over into the bad place. The tree is planted in a good place, and that's fine, but the branches need to be pruned. Of course, there might be individuals who are terribly negative. They're so negative that they clearly have undercut their existence in the next world. That's a person who doesn't live in the next world. A person who lives only for the here and now. person has no share, no interest, no desire, no transcendent inkling at all. So such a person, by definition, can't live in the next world because he hasn't built it. The next world is only what you build, not automatic. The next world is only what you build. The essential you is only if you build more than just a body. So a person who doesn't have a share over there, where will he get paid out for the good things that he did? Because even the most negative individual has done a mitzvah, has done lots of mitzvahs. So that person gets paid out here. That person may have an intensely good year, because he deserves reward for those mitzvahs. And although a reward cannot be paid for in this world, although a reward for a mitzvah is a transcendent thing, that the reward for which can only be transcendent, and Hashem would love to pay this person out for his very small mitzvahs in the next world where the payment belongs, but he's not there. This person hasn't built an existence in the next world, so he's not there to be paid out there. And looked at another way, this person's entire reality is this world, so the most reward he can be given is in this world, and have any other dimension of his personality or her personality. So that person gets paid out here. There's much more to it. There are some people who deserve reward in the next world and good here. There's some people who deserve bad there and bad here. So you can't make a superficial judgment of what a person's going through in this life and interpret what it means that they're holding in the next world. But this is a prime and cardinal theme in our idea of judgment. Let's apply to what we were trying to understand before. A person stands on Rosh Hashanah. The first judgment that happens is a person gets judged. How do you look in the next world now? Means, what's your reality? If you had to go there now, where would you be? And if that's where you'd be, we will now decide. The spiritual forces will align themselves to create for that individual what he needs this year, now, here, depending on what his judgment is in the next world. So the God says like this. It's clear now. With this information, we can now work out. If you want to know what's happening on Rosh Hashanah, when you stand there saying the words, wondering what's happening in the spiritual world, instead of being vague about it like most of us are, you can be clear. This is what happens. The very first thing that happens in Rosh Hashanah, the very first thing certainly happens by midday of the first day, you judge how you look in the next world. What you actually are. Do you live there? Don't you live there? Exactly who you are. Now, that's been established. And by the way, the Gon says that it's not only written, it's sealed also. It's written and sealed. It's signed and sealed instantaneously. Not wait till Yom Kippur. It's signed and sealed now. Depends. Some people who are exactly on the borderline. Could be that that's done later. But essentially it's signed and sealed now. And as soon as it's sealed, which means, what does it mean sealed? What does it mean signed and sealed? There's no book there in which there's a writing and then a seal put over it. There's no book. There's no hand. There's no ink. There's just you. The Tzadok HaKohen says the book that's opened is your heart. That's the book that's opened. And the writing that's done in it is what's there. It's what you've written in the course of your life. Once that's revealed, now it makes clear what you deserve now. What you deserve. What you deserve, not as a punishment, what you deserve as the things that you need to achieve what you need to achieve in terms of who you are. You define it. In other words, if you want to know what's going to happen next year, it's up to you. Up to you. Because depending on who you are, so you need this or that or the other next year. When a child reaches a certain stage, the parent, a thinking, intelligent parent who spends time thinking about these things, thinks about his child or her child and wonders where the child is now and makes an assessment of who the child is and then decides what to give the child. To give the child something difficult, that's an ordeal, so-called punishment, or to give the child encouragement, to give more, plenty to the child. Depends on how the child's functioning. The child's using opportunities well. Why would the parent ever withhold? The parent will give more opportunities. If the child's misusing opportunities, the parent may be forced to withhold opportunities. It all goes according to what the child is. When Hashem judges on Rosh Hashanah, it goes according to what you are now. And you define that. There's no external judgment that could possibly not be fair. It's not only fair, but it's you yourself. So it goes like this. First of all, you're judged instantaneously of what you look like, and that's signed and sealed. Then there's a judgment made for this world. What you deserve, therefore, in the rest of the year. And that's not sealed till Yom Kippur. That's signed on Rosh Hashanah, but you get 10 days to cry about it until Yom Kippur. Of course, the only way you can cry, the only way you can fix it up by Yom Kippur is changing who you are. You can't convince them You won't convince Hashem. You couldn't convince Hashem that he's got it wrong. That what he decided you need this year, a tough year, that he's got planned for you because that's best for you. You can't convince him that he's wrong about it. You make a mistake. Of course, the only way you can convince him, change his mind as it were, that you don't need what he had planned for you this year, is to become somebody else who doesn't need that. And the way you do that is go back and reopen the first judgment, even though it's been sealed. And that's why the Gemara in the same place says, Yafet ta'aka kredim zadin, ulachak zadin, that crying out helps before the sealing of a decree and it helps after the sealing of a decree. Of course, when you go back and change who you are, so now you need a new dispensation this year. The wrong one won't fit. The old one won't fit. And you have to Yom Kippur to do that. What have we learned? This is revision. We discussed this a few days ago. What have we learned? We learned that there's a remarkable feature. And by the way, just to make the story complete, don't want to leave behind those who weren't here. That's why the Gaon of Vilna says that you should not say, Neshama Tova Tekasei V'Techasem, as we do. It's our custom. You should definitely do, practically, you should definitely do what your custom is. There's no question. That's our custom. But according to the Kabbalistic custom, the custom of the Gaon, people don't say that. The custom according to the Gaon of Vilna is to say, Neshama Tova Tekasei, that's all. Not to say and be sealed. Because the Gaon says that what you're referring to is a good year. That's why you say Lashana Tova. You're talking about a good year. Good year means here. And the good year that you want the person to have here has been written on Rosh Hashanah, but it's not being sealed now. And therefore you can't say, and may you be sealed. It's not being done now. It's inappropriate. That's Yom Kippur when it's being sealed. So the appropriate greeting is to say, may you be written. Of course, that presupposes that the person's been written and sealed previously in the next world correctly. Otherwise, it's a curse what you're offering him. If you wish this person a good year now, and what you mean is that he should be paid out for his few miserable mitzvahs because entirely negative individual in the previous judgment, of course that's not good. And to say the whole thing would be too long. To say, may you be written and sealed in the next world positively. And according to that, may you be written now but not sealed till Yom Kippur. That would be too lengthy, say the poskim. And therefore, the God's custom is that you say just, may you be written for good in this year, presupposing a good writing and sealing in the next world prior to that, and you leave the words and be sealed until the time when they apply in Yom Kippur. A beautiful logical understanding was that. Well, this a person can understand clearly what exactly is happening on Yom Kippur. Now let's extract from this a detail that we can study further. You see that the first thing that happens in Rosh Hashanah is an assessment of who you are, the core of who you are. And according to the core and essence of who you are will be decided the practical details. The intention is the core of who you are. What you want, your rotzon, your intention, is the core, in fact it's the entirety, of who you actually are. Let's see if we can try and study this idea together. That's why, as we explained previously, the idea of Rosh Hashanah is not to fix up details. In fact, we don't do tshuva for details in Rosh Hashanah. Later, throughout the next 10 days in Yom Kippur, we try to fix up details. This detail of this relationship, and this detail of that relationship, and this mitzvah, and that other. But on Rosh Hashanah, what you're trying to do is define who you are correctly. From that you wish to flow out all the practical details. You don't have time on Rosh Hashanah to fix up all the details and make the resolutions and detailed intentions for everything. Detailed plan. What you need to do is define where you're going. What's your game plan? What's your strategy? What's your prime intention? This is not just because it's practical, but because Kabbalistically, you can't do anything unless there's been a seed of conception. Unless... A weak and faint analogy would be that if you run any business enterprise or any professional endeavor, whatever it is that you do for a living or whatever you happen to do that you take pride in and do well and professionally, nobody engages in any of those activities by just seeing what each day brings. Nobody ever hopes to be a success, just tackles each day as it comes. Anybody who does anything professionally has a strategy. Before you start out, you have a definition of where it is that you're going. It should be that in everything. Of course, our skill and talent is that we're marvelous at doing it in the irrelevant areas. We plan the next year's business activities down to absolute details, even sporting activities, all kind of inconsequential things we plan in detail. But what each child needs this year in terms of education, or what the definition of our relationship is in marriage, or other relationship, of course we don't give a thought to. We only begin to realize exactly what's happening in the relationship after it happens, after it's too late already. And most of our relationships are just patching up the mistakes of the lack of planning that led to mistakes that never would have happened had you had a consciousness of what the relationship is. Of course, the prime thing that a person should plan is who you are and where you're going in life. Apart from each child and each element in marriage and each other relationship, everybody has to sit down sometime and ask themselves exactly where who am I supposed to be? See, at least in a business enterprise, the business is sort of defined. You know, you either sell this or you sell that. But when it's you, and you haven't even decided what it is that you're selling, how can you hope to make any progress? A person should be agonized by the thought that maybe in a year's time you realize you've been selling the wrong goods. You have to retrace your steps, or 3 steps forward and 2 steps back, and hopeless activity. People who take this seriously do it every day, but at least once a year. At least once a year. Rosh Hashanah is the time. Rosh Hashanah is the time to sit down and figure out who I am. At least for this year. What has become of me until now, and what do I intend to do? Who am I? Where am I going? Not the details. That you'll have time to make strategy for the details. The mystics say, I mean, this is all so obvious, it's painful that we have to, it's painful and embarrassing that we have to think about these things and make them explicit. The mystics say that when a child is conceived, the organs and limbs of the child aren't built first. First there's a conception. Conception is where the planning dimension gets done, the genes get together. The first thing that happens when a child is conceived, the genes get together and there's a coding. And the definition of who this child is laid down. Then time goes by and this organ and that organ and this part and that part start getting formed. But you can't start having parts formed until there's a total definition, until there's a plan dimension. Rosh Hashanah is the conception of the year. Rosh Hashanah clearly, mystically, is the conception of the year. There are 10 mystical dimensions to the world. They're the first 10 days of the year. The first days when the conception occurs. That's where the male and female elements meet. And the year is defined now. You can never undo that. You can never undo that. If the genes are for blue eyes, they'll definitely be blue. You can hack crudely later with major surgery to try and change things. But you can't change. It's very, very difficult. And you can't ever change the essence. But on Rosh Hashanah, it's no effort at all. Later in the year, it's major effort to try and change anything and it won't be successful. But on Rosh Hashanah, before, while it's swimming into focus, you can form what it will be. So you can't afford not to use the day for that. If a person could genuinely reform who they are on Rosh Hashanah, they will definitely be different all year. There's no question about it. Couldn't be any other way. If you enter Rosh Hashanah with the slow, dragging holdover of what you are in the last month of the previous year, then you'll just get worse next year. No question about it. You won't be able to pull out of that. If you're alive next year because you were alive this year, you're dying. You have to be alive next year because you just came alive. Rosh Hashanah has to be a rebirth completely. You can't rely on anything that you've had from up to now. The Maharal says you can only rebuild something new if all the bricks are taken apart. If you leave any bricks together, then it's not new. It's an alteration. Got a whole month to prepare. Elul is the time to prepare. You're getting closer to it. Got a few days left. And that's what has to be done on Rosh Hashanah. Let's see if we can go deeper. This dimension of intention. This is what we mean when we say that it's a day of intention. It means planning. It means conception. That's what it means. It's a mistake on Rosh Hashanah to start getting involved in details. It's a mistake. It's the wrong order. Let's try and trace this idea deeper. This is very hard to express. It's impossible to express. One who is sensitive to these ideas will find that one knows them already. If you're not sensitive, the words won't help. But let's see if we can work on it with the crude words that are available. When any process begins that starts with a conception and follows on down into the practical, the closer you are to the conception, the more critical. But not only that, the more real as well. In fact, when you get close to the moment of conception, that's the only moment where you can make a difference. Let's try and understand this. The mystics say, we're allowed to talk a little bit about deeper things at this time of year. But we try, usually those who've come here before know, that we try to avoid speaking explicitly about mystical things because they're easily misunderstood and because there are people around teaching them in a very crude and exposed way, which is completely forbidden. But there are occasions when one's allowed to speak a little bit more openly. The mystics say that when you trace the process of anything, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a year, whether it's your own personality, whether it's any action that you do in the world, or even any thought, you find that the process is always the same. there's a root element that's very hard to name. Mystical terminology gives it certain names, but that's the root that contains everything. Let's call it the conception for now. From there comes a pregnancy, which is formative, but it's still very critical and still hidden. The conception is completely hidden. The pregnancy is hidden, but a bit more revealed. There's evidence that it's there, although what it is not revealed, just that it is there. And it's hard to be too explicit. And then there's a birth, which leads to a childhood, which is revealed in the world, but still with tremendous potential. And then finally, it fills itself out, fleshes itself out into a mature existence. The further back you go in the process, the closer to the beginning, the more control you have, the more critical the phase, and the closer you are to totality. Let's try and... The only way to discuss these subjects is by taking examples. Let's see if we can feel out the examples and get a feel for the MS of this. Let's say you take a thought. Let's take the mystical 10 stages, or five groupings, as the mystics say. You have what's called Rotsin, which is your will. Machshava, your thought. Hirhur, which is your thought in graphic detail. Dibur, which is speech, or translation of thought into action. And Maisa, the action. That's the process. The further back you go, the closer to the core, the closer to totality, and by far the harder to understand things become. Let's understand. Let's work backwards. Are you with me? First you have a desire. The desire formulates itself as a thought. The thought then clarifies itself into detailed plans. The plans then get translated into action, and the final action is the result. Everything must be that way in the world. So it must be Mashavat Chila. The final action is a perfect reflection of the original spark. The final child or person is an exact reflection of the way the genes sparked into unity. Let's move from the bottom up. Take action. That's clear, it's easy to understand, it's finite. What leads to action? Translation of thought into action. That's speech. It's called speech mystically, it's not only speech. Harder to understand. Go up into planning dimension in the mind. That's abstract. Much harder to perceive. I can't see that when it's in your mind. I can see the action when it's done, but I can't see the level of abstraction that's called here in your mind. But you can see it. You can see it because you can see the details falling into place. Let's go one step above that. You get to what's called machshava. Machshava is the idea, but before you become aware of its parts. And before that is the flash of the transition from nothingness in your mind to something in your mind. But as soon as it's something, it's too late. You're already in the next stage. Anyone with me? This is not hard to understand because it's how you think. Let's go through it together. You need an inspiration. You need a thought. You have a problem to solve. Or you need an idea. What happens? You struggle to get that idea. You look for inspiration. You can't do it deliberately. You can't do it at will. It's always a gift. It always comes from another dimension. All you can do is clarify the receiver. All you can do is clarify, crystallize your purity so that it can be given. And sometimes it takes minutes or hours or days or weeks or months. And you walk around lacking, desiring. The mystics say that the first part of the process is always desire. Rotsoin, desire, doesn't only mean your desire, it also means your desire to have this desire. Again, this has to be understood in the relationship between man and woman, which is hard to go into in detail also. That no spark is transferred unless there's desire in two dimensions first. Finally, what happens? At the least expected moment, you have that inspiration. And what happens is there's an electric moment when it sparks in, but you never catch that moment. Because as soon as you become aware that it's with you, you realize that the most powerful electricity is just gone. Again, it's very hard to put into words, but anyone who's ever experienced it knows exactly what this is. Because the definition of the first phase, what's called Rotsoin, desire, is the flashing across the gap, that infinite gap, between what is not, or rather what is in Hashem's mind, and what is in my mind, or that empty space that I am as yet. That point called Rotsoin, that point called desire, is the closing of the gap. It's the transition. It's where the two levels meet. The is not meets the is. But of course the interface between them is infinitely thin. So that all you can ever perceive is when it is. Of course, as soon as you perceive that it is, you realize it was just a spark that flew. But you can never experience that because you can only experience it when you have it. You can't. Once you have it, once it's with you, then you have what's called mashab, you have the idea. You don't know what it is yet. You're aware you have it. And of course, it's a tremendously potent moment. In that moment, you know that you have all the details. You know it's all there. You know it answers the questions. It answers all. You know that it's all there, but you haven't had time yet to see it all. But despite that, you know it's all there. And then, of course, it sinks into Hiru, where you have graphic images, and it starts playing itself out. And of course, it's much less exciting at that stage. Much less exciting. It's much less potent. It's much more spread out and diffused. It's much more womanly, as the mystics say. It starts being built in tangible reality. Starts having some pain. And then, of course, you translate it into action, and then it finally comes to rest in action. There's much to be said about this, but with that model in mind, you can understand that that moment of electricity, everything's contained there. Because from then on, it's just a running through the circuit automatically. From then on, it's mechanical. An animal or a machine can do just as well from that point on. The only thing an animal or a machine can't do is generate that original flash. Let's see if we can make this a bit more graphic. Let's take something very, very simple. Let's say you wish to move something from here to here. What happens? First of all, you have that intention, that desire, right? That spark. That then triggers some process in the brain. That becomes nerve activity. The nerves fire muscles. The muscles move the object. What component of that entire process, and of course it doesn't have to be moving this from here to here. It could be a kind word that you say to somebody that desperately needed it at that moment. It could be something very, very intimate and special. It could be something that the rest of your life and maybe other lives will never be the same again because of that small action. Let's trace that action. What part of it makes you human? Never mind Jewish, never mind spiritual. Just human. What part of it makes you human? Only the first part. Only the first part. The muscles that twitch, the monkey has also. The nerve impulses that made the muscle twitch, an animal can do just as well as you. In fact, does, and often better. The brain wave activity, the electrochemical activity in the brain, animal has that too. A computer has that much better as well. But where did it come from? Trace it back. Trace it back. What made the muscle move? The nerve impulse. What generated the nerve impulse? An electrical impulse in the brain. Where did that come from? Well, they get a bit uncomfortable, the physiologists, when you speak about this, because now they get close to getting close to the borders of what 3 billion years in the jungle bumping to each other can do for you. But you get back to some nucleus in the brain. The nucleus fired. Excuse me, what made that nucleus fire at that moment? We're talking here about an intimate expression of your own personality that has cosmic significance. Boils down to a few nerve cells firing in the brain. That's what it boils down to. Okay, what caused those nerve cells? Well, there was one cell somewhere that probably fired, right? There was a nerve someplace, a brain cell, that, you know, triggered it, fired. Fair enough. What made it fire? Well, there's some chemical change in it. No, where some... What caused that? They don't talk about that. Because they don't have tools to measure that. That comes from some other place. That transition from where there was no activity in those cells. I mean, I'm making it crudely graphic, but it applies to everything. The transition between where there was no activity in those cells, which means that the idea was not born that you would say these words to that person. The idea was not born yet. And then the next stage that you apprehend is where that is there. But there was a transition phase where a spark flew, and that can only be apprehended in a mystical or spiritual dimension. And of course that's why the scientific world says that you are just a monkey. Because with all the tools that they can ever use to measure, you are no different. They can measure a monkey from the moment that cell fires, and they can measure you from the moment that cell fires. But of course that doesn't make you human. So of course they come out to the conclusion that you're just an animal. And that's why there's a whole debate in the scientific world now. See if I can control my temper while I speak about it. There's a massive debate going on in the world of what's called artificial intelligence, the computer world. There's a massive debate now about whether we will ever produce a computer so sophisticated that it will be human. The one side says, of course we will. It's just that we haven't yet got enough interconnections in a small enough space that are fast enough and complex enough as the brain. But the brain is just a set of wires. That's all it is. It's just more complex than we can manufacture yet. But of course when we manufacture one as subtle with so many interconnections, of course we'll think like a person. These people get paid. Then there's another group that says, that doesn't sound right. That even if you've got it, it still wouldn't be human. There's still something in the human that's more than the sum of all the bits and pieces that are wired together. The only kind of individual who could even suggest that enough interconnections will make you think, enough interconnections will make a machine come up with an idea, such an individual, there's a serious question about his wiring. The most obvious thing to human understanding, the most obvious thing, is that there's a dimension to you that can't be put in terms of interconnections and wires. That's obvious, but again, it can never be expressed except in that dimension. You could never show that to somebody in terms of mathematics or the wires, because it's only apprehendable at a dimension where there are no wires yet. The fact that it can't be put into words doesn't mean it's not obvious. And of course, that's the difference between a man and a monkey. The difference between a human and an animal is that an animal does begin in his neurological functioning. He doesn't have any part to him that goes beyond that. That's why the word Bahama in Hebrew spells Bahama. It's what is in it. It is in itself. Whereas the word Adam, meaning a human, spells Ma'od, meaning very. Whatever you say it is, it's more and more and more. So what are we trying to say very crudely? We're trying to say that what makes you human, in other words, everything that you are that transcends being a machine or an animal, is in that infinite root that can't be named, that can't be grasped, that no machine can show. After that, you're running on automatic. Once the nerve fires, once the cell fires, and the nucleus fires, and the nerve fibers flash, and the muscle twitches, you're no different than a monkey. In fact, you can't stop it. Once the nerve impulse has been sent, in those few milliseconds that the nerve impulse takes to do its job, you're a monkey. You are an animal. You can't stop it, and the result will be like an animal's. The only difference between you and the machine, or between you and the animal, is that infinite second in which the desire, that original core, which is called Rotzoin, that's the only difference between you and something that's physical. And that's what Rosh Hashanah is. Rosh Hashanah is the moment of the year when that electricity flashes in. After then it's running on automatic. After then it is animal. After then it can't be stopped. Once the genes are formed, the baby must grow that way. After your intention, after the purity of your desire has been formed, what flashes in response to your desire, what the mystics say, once the woman's desire is formed, the response that's given to that, once that's there, the thing's determined already. The work is to ready yourself for that moment, to express that desire at that moment, so that what flashes in is new and different, and that you don't mind running on automatic from there. You can enjoy it from there, because it will be good. The word Ratzon in Hebrew, which means desire, this kind of desire, actually the root of the word is Ratz, which means the beginning of all movement, as the Medaktikim say. And also the word Ratzon, if you add up its grammatical, its Hebrew numerological value, it spells Makor, which means the source, or the womb for that matter. Makor in Hebrew means a source or a womb. That adds up to exactly the same number as the word Ratzon, because that is the source. It also adds up to Hashem's name, by the way, because that is the source. Shmoy, or his name, adds up exactly to the same numerical value as Ratzon, because the desire of the world is really what Hashem is. And that's what Torah is. Isn't Torah a revelation of what He wants? He doesn't do it. He's the source dimension. You do it. His desire is the Torah. Thou shalt do this and this and this. In other words, please, fulfill my desire. My desire is that this mitzvah should be done now. But He doesn't do it. The mouthpiece and the hands in the world are yours. The desire is His. The day of Rosh Hashanah is a day of gift, where you stand in that moment of electricity, you stand on that borderline between what isn't yet, a year that has not yet begun. As the sun dips below the horizon of Rosh Hashanah, you stand in a moment of electricity where a year that has never been is about to be, and you've never been that year, and you're about to be that, and it's unformed as yet. There's a conception about to take place. It doesn't go on a daily basis. It happens once a year. That's the mystery and the miracle of Rosh Hashanah. That's the moment that Adam was created. Adam was created on that day. He wasn't existing forever. He flashed into existence on that day. And how he flashed into existence is how he was forever. Your day of flashing into existence is about to be. On that very short, you don't have to concentrate for long. That's not a lot of work. You can't maintain it sustained, and that's why it's given as a gift, compressed into a short moment. In those few hours, if you hold strong, if you hold just for a few hours at a level that you've never been at before, you'll be that way forever. If you hold in those few hours as just a tired end result of what you've become, you'll just disintegrate further. What's remarkable about Rosh Hashanah is that it says that it's the day of the voice. The day of the voice. It says, Ashrei ha'am yodei trua. Happy is the people that knows the sound of the shofar. Whenever we talk about shofar, we talk about the sound. We talk about the voice of it. We talk about kol shofar, lishmoya kol shofar, who commands us to hear the voice or the sound of the shofar. What's this word kol? What's this word voice? Why isn't it just the sound of the shofar? Sound of the voice of the shofar? What is this idea of voice? Mystics say that where expression comes into being explicit, that means where your desire is hidden and begins to reveal itself, the beginning of revelation is voice. Let's see if we can understand this. When you speak, what we wish to do now is just try and understand the process of speaking on the same lines, the same model that we set up before in terms of how thought works. Let's see if we can follow that through in terms of speech. Where's the source of speech? It's the breath. Breath is your life energy. Vayipach ba'apav nishmas chayim. Hashem breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. The breath that's in your lungs, and of course that's why heart and lungs are in the life sustaining element of the body. That's where your life depends. Below the diaphragm is just maintenance and ongoing functions. But the life sustaining functions are in this level. But they're so deep that they're silent. They have no expression. The voice is silent. The sound of the voice, the sound of the breath, is silent. Breath doesn't have a sound. It comes from the deepest recesses of the life-sustaining, of the life-energy part of the body. It forces itself up through a connection level. The neck is always that mystical level of connection between the hidden source and the explicit revealed. In that phase of connection is where the voice is formed. Not the words, only the voice. All that's produced there is an unintelligible voice. It then comes to the organs of expression, which finally cut it into finite words. And you have speech? Let's analyze this. When the breath is within you, I can't hear it at all. The breath that's within you is the breath of Hashem's life. That has no sound. I cannot apprehend that. Only you can. When you wish to bring yourself into expression, the first thing that I can grasp is your voice. Before the words. Then the voice is shaped into finite words. And then I can understand it. Let's see if it follows the process that we described before. The closer to the root, the more potent. The closer to the life energy, the more all-encompassing. Absolutely. The voice is an intense expression of who you are. The words always lie. The voice doesn't lie, but the words lie. The words lie because they're finally completely finite. They are so finite that you can't begin to express in them that which... Whatever you mean to say to someone, if you have any, we're talking here about anything that's just above the level of being purely animal. Anytime you try to express anything that's basically just minimally above the animal, you never can find the words to say it. You never can. You never can find the words to say it. You always will be disappointed with your words. Because the words are finite. They can never convey more than the finite. And what you wish to convey is more than what's finite. The last thing you want this person to understand about something deep and important and cosmically significant in your relationship is what the crude and awkward finite words say. Everybody's illiterate and unintelligible when it comes to that. You don't even have the subtlety to explain a taste to somebody. Even in hours of talking, you can't convey a simple taste or the flavor of an experience or how you felt about something. You'd have to talk for hours. And even after you talk for hours, the only reason the person understands is because they've once understood it, not because you said it. So the words are always pathetic. The Maharal says, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't speak. Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't speak because he was holding on a level of truth. So those things can't be put into words. It wasn't a defect. The anti-Semitic education that we've been given is that he had an imperfection, a psychological problem, a trouble when he was 3 probably. And so he grew up, he started. He was not bad. In other, that's a travesty of Torah to speak that way. Moshe Rabbeinu was holding on a level of perfection. The fact that he couldn't speak was a sign of his perfection. He was holding in a level where things are as they are, and not the way the finite words chop them up and make them finite and imperfect. So of course he couldn't speak. Later, when the miracle of Torah happened, he was able to speak after Torah was put into the world, which is the infinite being put into the finite world. So the words are always finite. They're the finished product. They live in the finite world. Of course they have no transcendence to them. But the voice certainly does. Because the voice has not yet been shaped into the finite. The voice is the meeting of the infinite life force inside with the explicit word force on the outside. That's what the voice is. And that's why it comes. Why is it formed from the part of the body? That's the join between the inexpressible depth and the expressible superficial level. Because it's the join between the two. It's the first moment of expression. Now with this you can understand a few very, very beautiful things. When Hashem tells the prophet to go and prophesy, remarkable thing. He says, you read Tanakh, you read Torah, without understanding these things, it seems completely no way to understand. When Hashem instructs the prophet to go and tell the people of Jerusalem, people of Yerushalayim, to improve their ways, he calls out to the Navi and says as follows, Kra begaroin al tachsoich. That's what it says in Pasuk. Kra begaroin al tachsoich. Cry out in your throat, do not hold back. The voice can say, what does it mean, cry out in your throat? When you go and tell people how to behave, you don't do it with your throat, you do it with your mouth. You say the words. Not prophecy. Prophecy is a voice, it's not words. Prophecy is the root of the thing, the way it really is. The words could never convey it. The words would always squeeze it into the finite, and prophecy is transfinite. It's infinite, it's transcendent. And therefore, prophet can't speak with his mouth. If he spoke with his mouth, you'd hear finite words. It wouldn't be prophecy. The prophet speaks with his voice. You have this so many times. It says, when the two sons come in front of Yitzchak, what does he say? When Yaakov stands in front of him, he says, Ayadayim Yaday Esav. The hands are the hands of Esav. They're the hands that do, that act, that are finite in the world. Vakol kol Yaakov. But the voice is the voice. He didn't say the words. He didn't say the words. The voice couldn't be hidden. The words were being hidden. Yaakov was dressed up like Esav. His hands were hairy like Esav. And he was saying Esav's words. So the word, but the word, Yitzhak wasn't listening to the words. Because Yitzhak knew that when you want to penetrate the emissary, you don't listen to the words, you listen to the voice. So he said, the hands are the hands of Esav, but the voice, he didn't say the words. He said, Akol kol Yaakov, the voice of the Jewish people, the voice of Yaakov, that's what he listened to. And that Yaakov couldn't hide, even though he was trying. He was speaking as if he was Esav, and he was tripped, but the voice he couldn't hide. Because you can always penetrate the voice. When Sarah tells Avraham, Sarah tells Abraham some home truth about what has to be done in their home, about a child. And Avraham Avinu, as always the man, he's less sensitive than the woman in these things, feels that maybe this is a difficult thing to do, maybe it shouldn't be done. So he turns to Hashem, and Hashem says, Sarah Yishtucha, Sarah your wife, es kol asher, everything that she says, everything that she tells you to do, shma b'kola, listen to her voice. Isn't that beautiful? You don't listen to the woman's voice, you listen to what she says. When Sarah said that this child must leave the home, even though he found it difficult, what Hashem meant was listen to her instruction. The prophet should have said, Shma be'etzosa, listen to her advice, listen to what she says. But the prophet doesn't say that. The prophet says, Shma be'kela, listen to her voice. And Avraham Avinu understood immediately that what was meant was that what she'd said was on a prophetic level. Because the voice is the voice of truth, not the finite words. Anyone who knows anything about people knows how to listen to the voice and not the words. If you want to understand a person, you have to know how not to listen to the words, because the words are always false. In a relationship, even if the person is sincerely trying, the words will be false. Even if they're really trying, the words will be false. But the voice will never be false. Many systems have used this wisdom. There's a system of education where children who are unable to learn the explicit and detailed things that children who are more gifted are able to learn. Children who have such difficulty that they're considered unteachable completely. There's a system of education that teaches children like that to listen to the voice. They teach them sounds. They can't even teach them letters of an aleph bais. Children who can't even be taught an aleph bais. They are so severely hindered. There's a system of education that brings out these children to being human by teaching them to listen to the sound. They do it with sound and movement. They teach them ah, and they teach them s. They teach them the sounds. And the child hears from the voice that's being expressed exactly what's meant. Once in Poland, there was a decree, a terrible decree against the Jews. It happened many times against Kita and against Jewish education, Torah education. It was in the days of the Chofetz Chaim. So they appealed to the Chofetz Chaim to go and speak to the minister, the Polish non-Jewish minister, who had represented the government in this particular matter and issued this national decree against this religious activity. So the Chofetz Chaim, there was nothing else for it. He went to see this minister. He must have been in his late 80s or early 90s. The Chofetz Chaim didn't speak Polish. He came in front of the minister, was received by him. This elderly Jew, supported by two people who were with him, and the Chofetz Chaim began to speak. And he spoke in Yiddish. And the minister did not speak a word of Yiddish. The Chofetz Chaim spoke to him about why this was an evil thing to do, and how. Spoke the truth. When the Chofetz Chaim finished speaking, the interpreter stepped forward to put it into Polish, and the minister says that I understood perfectly. He said, you don't have to say a word. And he completely annulled the decree. It was overturned immediately. He said, I didn't understand a word, but I understood everything. Listen, there's a power of voice that will come across. That is the reason why we talk about the kol shofar. The sound of a shofar is just a voice. It doesn't have words. The reason we use shofar is that it doesn't have words. It's just the breath being given voice. And that's why the shofar is just like a cry. It's like a sad cry, like a crying cry, like a shouting, but it's voice only. When voice is expressed as voice and not as words, it's much more powerful. There are no words in the world to describe the scream of a child in the night. But once you've heard it, you'll never forget it. That's what the shofar is. That's the scream of our child in this night. That's the idea. We can't get through Rosh Hashanah with words. You can't do that. Making a speech is not going to help. Any speech that you can make will be so plastic and so pathetically phony that we'll be sealed for doom that year. Hashem in His chesed gives us the opportunity not to get up and make speeches on Rosh Hashanah, because we've perverted the tools of speech and we've made them so coarse and crude and finite that it would be a disgusting exercise if we had to make speeches and put into words what we want to put into words, even if we could. And therefore the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah is not to say words, it's just to scream. Because the scream is expression of voice, which is the core of what you want to say, and that can never be misunderstood. And that's why shofar is the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah. The day of Rosh Hashanah is establishing the root. It's working on who you are at core, what you are as a voice before you start putting it into thought out words. It's going back to the conception of what it is that you want to say. The shofar teaches you that when you hear that sound, you're not meant to be listening for what it is saying. That's not the point. The point is that you're listening to voice here, to sound in the world, to the root of expression. It's a throat crying out. That's what shofar is. And that's why it has its incredible power. And the work that a person has to do on himself is to remember that this is a day when conception is taking place. It's the cry, it's the voice that a child has before he has words, that's perfectly expressive. The mother understands the voice of a child long before the child begins to say words. When a child begins to say words, it begins to deceive. But while he's still using voice only, can never deceive. Never deceive. The work of Rosh Hashanah is to descend, to go back into that phase of being that child, being that moment of conception, going back to that point that's called Ratzon, trying to connect with that electricity where it just begins to be revealed, the beginning of expression before expression has been formulated into details, and prepare oneself so that that moment, just and only for that moment, the spark will fly in the kind of purity that will make the rest of the year all be lived on that level of purity.